Hello, welcome to Radio Evolve. Hello, Rob Hopkins.
Hello. Well, lovely to see you. Thank you for inviting.
Great to see you, Rob Hopkins. You are co-founder of the Transition Movement with Transition Towns that reach many countries. Now you are an author, a speaker, podcast host, so very, very active in that whole area of regenerative transformation or regeneration. And your latest book is called How to Fall in Love with the Future. And that's also the context that we are speaking, and also our new issue of Evolve magazine, where we are moving with the question, what can we trust in a world that is falling apart? What would you say to that?
Oof. It's a big question. What can we trust in a world that's falling apart? I think we can trust the power of communities. We can trust the collective intelligence, if facilitated properly, through things like citizens' assemblies. I think we can trust critical thinking. I think we can trust passion and kindness as a motivation for the action, for activism that we do. There are people in the world who are opinion shapers and writers and journalists who I have learned over the years to trust and whose opinion I really value. I think we can trust that art and beauty and music are vitally important for our well-being. There's a few things to start with anyway. Big question.
It's a bit of...
I know I could give you a much, much longer list of things that we can't trust, but that's not the point of the exercise.
Yeah, it's a bit of a jump start, but I was curious.
Yeah.
And but you taking, I mean, also what you're naming in your answer, you are taking as an activist who is really also engaged since so many years in activism in different ways. You're taking a certain stand, you can say, or approach also in, you know, your new book, which is to not only focus on the things that are going wrong or that we could, you know, that could lead to collapse or breakdown in certain ways, but on the future that is possible. Can you say a bit why this is so vital for you to point yourself and others in that direction?
I think we, you know, since the beginning of the transition movement, there was always an element of visioning, and visioning is important, that we shouldn't just leap in and start doing things without bringing people together to figure out, well, where are we going? What do we want to create? What do we hope this place will be like in the near future if we really push to make that a reality? And then in about 2021, which was 2020, sort of in the middle of Extinction Rebellion, which I think was an extraordinary, has been an extraordinary movement, and which very much centered on narratives around extinction and collapse. And quite rightly, because I think it's very important that the world has a wake-up call to what's going on. But it's not enough on its own. And I was getting a bit frustrated with just reading books by middle-aged white men about collapse and extinction. And I saw this T-shirt a young woman was wearing on a Black Lives Matter protest in Washington, which said, "I've been to the future. We won." And it gave me enormous goosebumps. And it kind of encapsulated for me a really different way of approaching activism that we do. I feel like everybody who is motivated by narratives around collapse and extinction is already on board. Like, we've engaged everyone. We're going to engage with that. And it's not enough. It's nowhere near enough. It's actually quite a small proportion of the population who can take that sort of... information on board and use it and then convert it into doing some action in the world. So it then sent me down this journey, which was also partly came out of the podcast that I did and people that I was interviewing on that podcast, of mostly women of color in the United States who are writing about imagination and kind of radical imagination and futurism and time travel in ways that I just found so refreshing and so extraordinary. People like Adrienne Marie Brown and Mariam Kaba and Ruha Benjamin, Black Quantum Futurism, just blew me away. And so that then I started, I'm sure you've had the same experience, Mike. You know, sometimes you read something or you see something, experience something, and you think, I need to let this change me. I don't want to be the same after this as I was before. And so I then started doing my talks with this sort of slightly absurd character that I created for myself, where I had was a time traveler who'd built a time machine and who'd just come back from the future that was a result of us doing everything we possibly could have done. And it's so amazing. And I need to tell you all about it. And I found that it moved people in ways that nothing I'd done before really did. So I guess for me, in answer to your question, it's we have been very, very good, I think, in the climate movements at giving people things to run screaming in the opposite direction from, and not so good at giving people things to run towards. I spoke to, for my podcast, I interviewed Solitaire Townsend, who does a lot of work around this sort of stuff, and who's also an expert on Shakespearean theatre. She said, as a movement, we've been brilliant at Act One. Act One is the act where you set up the play, you identify the bad guys, you identify the tension that's there. And then we've just got stuck in Act One, going round and round, saying it louder and louder and louder. Act Two then is when you go on a journey and you meet different people and you find that there's the universe kind of rises up and you to give you support, and you find the inner resources you didn't think you had. And it's about connections and relationships. And that's where that comes from. We haven't been so good at that bit. And when I look back, you know, that often within the climate movement, we have these debates around, should we be more like Malcolm X or more like Martin Luther King? When we look back to the civil rights movement in the United States in the 1960s, because Malcolm X was more radical. So then that pushed the Overton window, which made Martin Luther King seem more acceptable. And often we just get stuck in that. Should we be more like Extinction Rebellion or more moderate in our activism around climate? But what we often miss out of that analogy is that also within the civil rights movement at that time, you had the Black Panthers, who were running free school meals programs, running ambulances into neighborhoods where no one else would go. You had all of that. And you had this extraordinary Black utopian tradition of writers like Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney. You had musicians like Sun Ra and Parliament Funkadelic, what we now look back and call Afrofuturists, who were filling the future with these stories that centered the Black experience and Black futures. And I think we often miss that bit out of the wider movements that we have around climate. And so what I've been trying to do is to bring that bit in as well, and to allow more, create space for more kind of playfulness and silliness. And but also, it's for me, it's quite a profound practice, that idea that we open the door to the future and name the future and describe the future. And in these days now where it feels like the future is being cancelled and the future is being colonized, it feels to me like profoundly important work to be doing.
Mm-hmm. And I found it also interesting, and looking in your book, that you highlight that so much, as you also doing now, that you were so inspired by these voices from, you know, from Black communities, or also from indigenous communities, or from non-binary people. What was your exploration there? Why do you think what inspired you in that maybe voices or sources that maybe haven't been so much in the foreground?
Yeah, well, when I started doing the podcast, I set myself a kind of a principle that I would every episode had two guests, and I promised I would never do an episode that had two white male guests in it. I wanted to push myself to reach beyond the usual pool of people who always end up on each other's podcasts. And I found this, like I mentioned before, this extraordinary kind of, it's not really a movement. It's like a kind of I don't know if it's even a scene, but it's a bunch of different, mostly women in the US who are writing about this stuff. And I guess for me, you know, it's like I mentioned before, you know, there's lots of books. Most of the books about collapse are written by middle-aged white men like me. And maybe it's partly a reflection that for the first time in a very long time, maybe for middle-aged white men, maybe the world is collapsing a bit. Do you know what I mean? It's like actually the things are shifting around, and so to read things written by people who come from a culture where historically everything collapsed profoundly 400 or 500 years ago with the mid-Atlantic slave trade and then the vicious kind of institutional racism that has followed in its wake still to this day. But they weren't writing books about collapse and extinction. They were writing books about imagination and time travel and science fiction as strategy and dipping into the work of Octavia Butler and how she talked about the future and the extraordinary prison abolition movement in the United States, which is such an incredibly generative movement because it says, what if there were no prisons? And then that opens up the question of people say, well, yeah, but if you had no prisons, you'd have to have a very different kind of education system. Yeah, keep going. You know? And the fact that that movement has existed for 50 years, 100 years, exploring those questions. And then the same thing often within queer culture, you know, that exploration about, well, what if gender isn't binary? And actually, what if it's a long continuum and people can be at any place along that continuum and people can reimagine who they are on an almost daily basis? I find that massively liberating. And kind of indigenous futures movements and the Afrofuturist movement is something that I take a huge inspiration from because it's so kind of bright and colorful and playful. And I've found more inspiration and more joy and more insight in immersing myself in the work of people like that than I did in the work of the people who I would otherwise be reading, I think. Not to knock that, and I'm not, and off, you know, not to say that we shouldn't be talking about collapse and extinction and that we shouldn't be writing about that because it's a very real possibility, and actually at the moment it's definitely the most likely possibility, but what I found from reading those people was a kind of a merging of this idea which was kind of going on in my own life at the time that either we're artists or we're activists. What I found in that world was this sort of really bringing those two things together, that you can be both of those things at once, which actually, as somebody like me who went to art school when I was 18 and who still draws, but very much in my spare time, and who always saw that there was kind of artist Rob and activist Rob, to over the last few years be bringing those things much more closely together, I think maybe also fed into why I drew so much inspiration from those people.
Mm-hmm. And you work or play with that idea of time travel quite a bit. I mean, also, yeah, as a kind of a way to approach people. But you also researched on the effects of it. Why has that become so crucial? This idea to being able to travel into the future and connect to a future possibility that way.
I guess for me, the book asks two main questions, one of which is, what would our activism look like if instead of seeing our role as being to give people enough terrifying information that they'll act, if instead we saw our work as being around the cultivation of longing for a different future? But the second question is, what if we did our activism as though time travel were possible, which is a slightly more eccentric question, I will grant you. But I found that as I was starting to do the research, I was coming across amazing activists and artists who were playing with time in really interesting ways. You know, often when we're activists, our work gets very much stuck in the present. We're very much rooted in the present. You know, every demonstration you go on, people say, when do we want it? Now. No one ever says, when do we want it? In about 180 years or 5.5 years ago. Like now. And then I found people like Black Quantum Futurism, like an amazing artist in the United States. I've forgotten her name. It'll come to me in a moment. Who does this incredible project called Afronautic Research Labs, and other people who were taking this approach to activism, where they would help people to step into the future, to understand the past, and mixing it all up, what I call in the book temporal fluidity, this idea that we move through them, because this idea that time is this linear process that just ticks minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day, year by year, is quite a recent thing, that kind of Newtonian time. And what Rashida Phillips writes about from Black Quantum Futurism is the links between that sort of linear time and colonialism and slavery. One of the first things that you do as an invading, colonizing power is to arrive into a culture that already has an incredibly sophisticated understanding of time. Some traditional African understandings of time is actually running backwards. You know, indigenous Australian understandings of time have this incredible sense of deep time that spans huge distances in time. And then you arrive, you put up a tower with a bell on the top that rings every hour, and you start to restructure everybody's lives around that. And so she does this beautiful work around reclaiming different understandings of time and how time is used as we live in a society where time is not equally distributed. Some people live lives of extreme time poverty, and other people have plenty of time. I remember reading that before H.G. Wells wrote The Time Machine, in 1895, this idea that you might intentionally move from one place to another in time never occurred to anyone, not to Shakespeare, not to Jules Verne, not to anybody. But as soon as he wrote that, everybody understood what that meant. So if I stand, and anything can be a time machine, right? When you write books. So if I stand up in front of 1,000 people and say, this empty jar of honey is in fact a time machine, no one ever says, ah, Rob, come on now, explain to me the quantum mechanics of that. They say, oh, cool, where are we going? And there's a huge amount that you can do with that. Because like Bell Hooks said, what we cannot imagine cannot come into being. And if I can use that to theatrically give people a sense that I have just returned from that future, I think there's something very powerful about, in times that feel really uncertain and dangerous, to have people step back through the fabric of time and go, I've just been to check it out for everybody, and actually it's amazing. It works out fine. Don't worry about it. There's something really powerful about that. So I do a lot of work now using lots of different ways to give people an experience, like I said before, when the future is being cancelled and the future is being colonized, giving people an experience of stepping forward into time is a very powerful thing to do. What we're doing is helping people to create memories of the future, to create a nostalgia for the future. And all the research shows that actually that's a very powerful way to increase people's commitment to making change happen, their sense of agency. And it's also much more playful and much more fun. And it's also not what is expected of us. You know, the sort of people's mental stereotype of a climate activist is it's going to be really long and boring and miserable, and everyone's going to be really, really grumpy. And actually, the more we can subvert that, I think there's a real power to that too.
Mm-hmm. And when you do this kind of lectures, or, you know, take people into that perspective, what do you see happening? What do you see liberated or showing up for people, or in the space you are doing that?
So when I do that exercise, I ask people to, I tell them I've brought my time machine along with me, which is a bit of a theatrical flourish. And then I ask them to close their eyes and to imagine, and I have different ways that I facilitate it, but the idea is basically that they are leaving 2026 and then they're arriving into the 2036 that was the result of them doing everything, of us doing everything we could have done. So it was this incredibly transformative 10 years that nobody in 2026 could see coming, but it's done that strange thing. And we're going to step out into that future, and we're going to take a walk around. And then I asked them, keeping their eyes closed, to turn to the person next to them and share with them what they saw. Mm. And then we hear back into the room. And I've done that. I was figuring out the other day, I've done that exercise, I think, with about 15,000 people over the last few years in big, big events and small workshops. And it's so interesting how universal people's responses are. You know, people talk about cities are much greener, they're much softer, the air smells better, the bird song is louder, people are less stressed, people are doing more meaningful work, people have more time, there's more public art, there's better mental health for young people, there are fewer cars, there's more bicycles. Like, thousands and thousands of people have told me that, you know. And there's a woman called Elise Boulding, who's a Quaker, who was also the person who first invented peace studies as an academic discipline in the United States in the early 90s. She was doing a very, very similar exercise with men in men's prisons in the early 90s. And she wrote a beautiful paper where she captured what they told her they imagined when they imagined a future in that way, almost identical to what people are now telling me like 35, 36 years later. And her conclusion was, I think we have many more allies for the work ahead than we might think we do. So it's something that's, I think what it does is that we live in an economy which is all about pleasure and desire and selling us things that release dopamine for a short period of time, and then we need to get something else. And we know that when you base an economy on pleasure and dopamine, you see a rise in addiction and a rise in depression. I think what this activity does is it bypasses that, and it allows you into a future that's based on contentment and based on happiness. And one of the things I did in my podcast was that I started every episode like that with my two guests. I would ask them to shut their eyes, and we would travel forward. We would walk around in that future, and then we would come back. And then at the end, we did a bonus thing that was called the Ministry of Imagination. And I would inaugurate them as ministers in this imaginary government ministry. And I'd say, you can come up with three policies, any three policies you will like, as bold, as audacious, that would really accelerate our journey towards this. And in 2024, I realized that year there were more elections than any other year in human history, of the most important elections, mostly people voting on policies with on manifestos with no imagination in them at all, really. So I edited all of those 600 policies together into a document, which people can find on my website, called the Ministry of Imagination Manifesto. And when you put them all together, you start reading it, the first few pages, you're thinking, oh yeah, right, like that's going to happen, I don't think. And then, but then after a few pages, you find yourself going, yeah, we could though, couldn't we? Actually, we could do that, couldn't we? We could do that. So that's what I try and do, is like, when I present those futures and help people to those futures, it's not saying this will be the future,
mm-hmm.
but I'm saying this could be the future. And if we shut that out as a possibility and we negate that as a possibility, then it's just absolutely never going to
happen. Mm-hmm. So what I hear you also saying is there is something in us as human beings that somehow, given being in a space where that can show up, where we kind of from our inner sensing, what is a good, a healthy, a kind of fulfilled life, know how that could look. I mean, in different ways, obviously, but would you say that there is a kind of a inner sense in us that we can draw on or not draw enough on,
yeah,
where we actually know what that could look like?
I think it's... I think what I've learned from doing that is that it's much more universal than we might think. You know, we live in this world which is very polarized by social media, and this lot of people hate this lot of people, and these people are right and these people are wrong, and nobody will ever agree on anything. Actually, when you do that exercise, you realize maybe, yeah, like Elise Boulding said, we have a lot more in common than we might have thought we yet do, and that maybe that also gives us a really good platform on which to start. You know, maybe we start there and then we work backwards, figuring out how we might get there. How do you build a good society? You know, like there's very interesting work by Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, who wrote a book called The Spirit Level a few years ago, which showed that all the things you want a society to do to have lower teenage pregnancy, better education rates, better teeth, better mental health, a better sense of kind of civic cohesion and trust, all of those things improve the more equal a society becomes. And Kate just wrote a really good book, which is called The Good Society, which I really, really recommend. It's fantastic, which is about actually we could create a society where people are much healthier and people are better educated, and it's not a huge leap to make. It's all entirely possible. It's only this weird thing that we've allowed to take hold over the last 40, 50 years that change can't happen quickly, and change has to be very unambitious. And we just need to have everything in little incremental little steps, and we can't do bold, imaginative things. You know, if the climate change is really a failure of the imagination on the most epic scale. And I would hate for humanity to be the species that goes extinct, leaving a headstone that just says, sorry, we couldn't think of anything else. You know, I think we're better than that. And our history shows there are many times when people are motivated and do incredible stuff on behalf of each other and improving the world for each other. This time is no different from any of those other times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you're speaking about also is this a kind of ability for imagination, also collective imagination. Mm-hmm. How do you see that quality in ourselves? I mean, how would you distinguish that from you know, just making up a fantasy so we kind of are not so depressed kind of thing? And just saying, oh yeah, maybe it's gonna be good or something like that. And to that real capacity of imagining that it can be different, and that can be a real source also of that kind of change you are pointing to.
So Rebecca Solnit, who's an amazing American journalist and writer, she says, hope is not a lottery ticket that we sit clutching on the sofa. It's an axe you use to break down doors. Mm. And Mariam Kaba, who's the amazing prison abolitionist in America, who I had the great honor to interview on my podcast, she says, we must imagine while we build, always both. I am not for a moment, and the book is very clear in saying, I am not saying all we need to do is to sit around and imagine. That's very nice. It doesn't really get us anywhere. It has to be coupled with action. It has to also be coupled with supporting people to then turn that imagination into making things happen. We have to give it people experiences where they can rehearse the future. In Bologna in Italy, the municipality, when they noticed a real decline of people being involved in democracy, created what they called a civic imagination office with six laboratories around the city, where they invited people together to, in really well facilitated events, to imagine the future in different ways. And that led, what the brilliant part about that was, that after people had done the imagining and had come up with ideas of things they wanted to happen, the municipality would sit with them and say, that's a great idea. Let's make that happen. We can offer this and this and this. You can offer that. Let's make a pact. And so in the last few years in Bologna, they made 500 pacts between the municipality and the people that range from making a new little garden somewhere, through to really ambitious things like turning an empty building into a new school to train young people as classical musicians. It's now the main way the municipality finds use for empty buildings. You know, we see other cities now that are using citizens' assemblies for all of the big decisions that they need to make. But if we just do action without engaging the imagination, without a kind of a vibrant sense of what the future could be like, it's all a bit joyless. It doesn't achieve as much as it could do. It doesn't really bring people along with us. You know, we end up in a big sort of fight about, well, we have to reduce our carbon footprint by 20% within 10 years. What does that mean to anybody? It's all just becomes like numbers and policies. You know, we need to find the, you know, when I was saying before, one of the questions in the book is, what does our activism look like if we put the cultivation of longing at its heart? With that, I think, comes a recognition that those of us who are activists and who've been doing this kind of work for a long time are not very good at cultivating longing. It's not what we do. It's not what we're trained to do. Climate scientists are even worse. It's not their job to cultivate longing. The people in our culture who are good at that are street artists and poets and writers and so on and so on. We can't do this without those people. Mm. So the book, as much as anything, is really a kind of an appeal to artists and writers and so on to get involved in the creation of longing at scale. Don DeLillo, the novelist, said, longing on a large scale is what makes history. Mm-hmm. And I think we should never forget that. And we can't do that in a context that's just people talking about policy and ideas and numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think with that, you also speak something about something that is deeply, deeply there in every human being. I mean, to me, it sounds also like a somehow, you know, a soulful approach, like that this kind of longing for, you know, a better future or a healthy life or a kind of a world where life can really flourish is also something that is, you know, that is deeply in us, and also the capacity of imagination, like you were just the examples you are mentioning, that there's also something that it's not just a nice tool, this kind of imagination, but it's somehow also what we are made of as human beings, that when that is activated, then we become, you know, we become alive, we become, you know, we shine, maybe you can say, we become creative. We want to do something. We want to work together with other people to create something, and not just, yeah, like you're saying, follow some orders or some, you know, some rules to get there. And I think it's drawing on a creative capacity that we have as human beings that is often doesn't really have space to come forth and to show itself.
Yeah, I think there's that quote, and I whether I get the name right or the quote right, I might get neither right, but I think it was Emma Goldman who said something like, if this is a revolution where I can't dance, then I'm not interested. You know, it's like, actually, how do we make it feel more like a party than a protest march, and the beautiful thing about imagination for me is it's so unpredictable and playful. Ursula Le Guin, one of the great guardians of our collective imagination, she once said that the word creativity has been so abused by capitalism that I don't use it any longer. She said, but they can't have imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You know, imagination is ours. Imagination is mischievous and naughty and doesn't do what it's supposed to, is unpredictable, and it feels great. You know, it's like the book that I wrote before this one that was called From What Is to What If, that was about what's the state of health of our imagination right now. Is it the case that climate change is a failure of the imagination, and if so, why are we having a failure of the imagination at this vital moment in history? And as part of that, I became obsessed with this idea of what would it feel like to live in a culture where the imagination was coming back. You know, we've lived with this erosion of the imagination, I think, since the mid-1990s, where it has been designed out of our education system, out of most people's work life. It's been designed out of our public life, out of our politics. There's, in many schools, there's not even any resources for art, for creative writing. All of that has been devalued and devalued, and to a point where I think we now are living in a real times of real imagination crisis and imaginative poverty. And so I went up to Dundee to visit a project called Art Angel, which works with people with mental health problems, burnout, stress, trauma, and uses art as a way to help them kind of repair themselves or reimagine themselves. And they're on the first floor of an office block in the middle of Dundee, and people come who either their doctor send them or they just decide that's what they need. And I spoke to so many people who told me how they were reimagining themselves through this process. It was very moving, actually. And they, every year, to assess how they're doing, They don't give their artists, they call them artists. They don't call them clients or patients. They call them artists. And they give them a piece of paper to evaluate how well they're doing. Not a multiple choice questionnaire. It's a piece of paper with two outlines of a human body. And they say, fill the first one to show how you felt before you came to Art Angel. And the second to show how you feel now that you've been coming here for some time. Sure. And I looked through a big pile of these. It was very, very moving. And one that really stood out for me was one where the before character, they had just taken black paint and just splattered black paint onto this silhouette of a person. And the after one was all done in glitter and had wings and was this beautiful, colorful, gorgeous thing. And I always look at that picture. I use it in my presentations and I say, you know, this is, that's what it would feel like to live in a time of imaginative renaissance. Wouldn't that be incredible? Don't we want our children to live in a time where the imagination just flourishes? There have been times in history where that has been the case, incredible times to live through. And I think we're due for one of those times now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It also makes me wonder, you know, the question that I asked in the beginning, you know, what can we trust in a world that is falling apart? And in a certain way, what is, you know, what we are talking about is also a kind of certain way of understanding the world is falling apart or is coming really to its limits, which is a kind of, you know, a kind of trying to manage things in an instrumental way or control things or regulate things and all that. And in a certain way, what I hear you saying is, yeah, that world maybe needs to fall apart to give rise to a world that has much more of this imaginative resources being brought into life. You mentioned that this is also really, and that is not a kind of byproduct of maybe moving to a better future, but is actually part of it or it, that it's not just about, you know, how do we survive maybe this time, but who can we be as human beings, like you were saying, and that,
yeah,
how can we be as human beings and be together when that kind of imaginative capacities are flourishing, and that is interesting. That is already a kind of vision. It's a bit a kind, yeah, of a connection to the future. Wow, that could be. But also, in a certain way, that is also something that we all have available to us also now. I mean, this capacities, and that's what I understand you're trying also to do, to to envision the future and create this longing or this love for the future, and see. But it's already here because, you know, we can be touched by it and we can feel like, wow, that would be amazing. Or like you're saying, through art, people, you know, we can reimagine ourselves also in our, you know, ways, yeah, how we are in the world.
I mean, I think the other thing that I talk about a lot is the fact that the future that we need to create, if you know where to look, is already here. The weak, mm-hmm, what astronomers would call the weak signals of that future already exist. And I loved a little while ago when they had the big power cut in Spain and Portugal and the south of France for 3 days. I saw someone on LinkedIn did a post where they said, well, for the first 3 hours, everyone was really worried. We didn't know what was going on. And then it got to 5 o'clock and everybody went out of their houses and bought a bottle of wine and a barbecue and some musical instruments. And we all met in the street and we all had a really nice evening together. They said it was like being in a Rob Hopkins book. And I love this idea that we have a word for it, because actually the other way around with dystopian stuff, we have words for it, right? We say, oh, it was like 1984, or it was like The Handmaid's Tale. We know what that means. But we don't have the words for it the other way around, you know. So it's, you know, but I think it's really important as well to make the point that I'm not saying that through the power of imagination, we can make climate change disappear. You know, we are now so far already into a process If we had started doing this work 20 years ago when we started the transition movement, if the rest of the world had moved with the same ambition and purpose as we did when we started the transition movement, the world would look very different now. This would have been a much, much easier thing to tackle 20 years ago. We are not now in a time where we can say that that climate change is going to go away. Climate change is with us now. The question is on what scale and at what trajectory, because we know that every tenth of a degree that the world rises pushes another 100 million people out of a kind of a livable context and makes life very, very, very hard for those people. And we're already at 1.5, and people are saying we might hit 2 degrees by 2040 or something like that, which is very, very soon. So, and we have lost things and we will continue to lose some things. So this is not some kind of happy clappy kind of hopium kind of utopian thing. You know, for me, you know, climate, I always say to people, if you aren't regularly terrified about the climate emergency, you are not paying attention, and we really need you to pay attention. What I'm exploring, though, is whether there are different tools that we might use to mobilize people around that. Because this idea that the only reason it's not happening is because people don't have enough information doesn't work. And we need very different kind of approaches. So it's really about what's the most skillful way at this point to put the brakes on. And yeah, we will lose some things. But actually, what some people would consider to be collapse, like you say, is really the emergence of something else. The day when BP and Shell collapse, for some people, is a collapse. For the rest of us, for the biosphere, it's the beginning of something else much, much better than that can take its place. So there are things that we have to that have to collapse and that we have to get rid of in order to be able to survive on this planet. And we should, you know, we should embrace the fact that this will not be a transition without losses along the way, but some of those losses will be things that we had to get rid of anyway, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also speaking in your book that this is really also a practice, like the you know, to cultivate our imaginative capacities or our ability to be aware maybe also of the weak signals of the future already now. Can you say more to that, how you see that as, yeah, how each one of us can move into that practice of becoming a time traveler maybe, or an artivist?
Yeah, well, I think the thing that I learned from writing From What Is to What If is that in our brains, if we're imagining the future or remembering the past, it's the identical networks happen. It's the same parts of the brain. The hippocampus is the part of our brain where the imagination and our memory both come from. It's also the part of the brain that is most vulnerable to cortisol. When we are stressed, anxious, in trauma, the hippocampus can shrink by up to 20%. And when that happens, we lose the capacity to think about the future in positive and hopeful ways. So when we are trying to imagine the future, it's our memories that help us to create that vision of the future. So if we just watch Fox News all day and then someone asks us to imagine a low carbon future, that's really hard because we've got nothing to work with. We've got no materials. We're going to the cupboards of our memory and looking through, and we can't find anything at all. So it's why one of the most powerful, I think, and important things that we can do is to find those stories of things that are already happening. So I try and get as many of them in the book as I can. Well, of course, we can change the way that our towns and cities feed the schools because they're doing it in one stop too in France. We can create whole neighborhoods where there are no cars because that's what they're doing in Freiburg in the Vauban. We can create cities with the most astonishingly good cycling infrastructure because that's what's happening in Utrecht and Rotterdam and Amsterdam and Copenhagen and increasingly in Paris. And we see all the benefits that then come with that. So we're living in a time, I think, where Silicon Valley and other and governments like to tell us that we have to spend billions and billions on innovation. I'm not convinced that we need to spend billions on innovation because we already know how to do everything that we need to do in order to save ourselves. We just need to get on with doing it. And often those things aren't tech kind of solutions. Often they're about redesigning where the streets go and taking up the hard surfaces. And you don't need innovation to do that. The piece that's missing is how do you cultivate longing for that at scale? And that links back to stories, that links back to media, it links back to how we talk about this stuff, which again, if we just talk about collapse and extinction all the time, we lose that, I think. I would say to people that practice of imagining traveling to the near future and walking about should become a daily practice in the same way that yoga or meditation or running are for some people, because the reality is that doing the opposite of that is a daily practice for all of us. We wake up in the morning, we turn our phones on, we look at the news, and then all the joy gets sucked out of everything, and our idea that anything could ever not be like this just completely disappears. So for me, there is a practice there, which is whether it's a magazine like Positive News or Imagine 5, which is a Dutch magazine full of solutions of change, whether it's following the transition movement or, you know, there are a number of people now who are posting these stories of things that are happening. Every town, every city, there's so many amazing things going on there and people doing amazing things. They never, very, very rarely get into the media, but all around you, there will be amazing things going on. Find out what they're doing, volunteer with them, learn what they're doing, and fill the cupboards of your memory with those stories. So the next time someone tells you, yeah, but this, you know, it has to be like this because it's always been like this, and there is no alternative, that you know that that's rubbish, and you can challenge that because you know that's rubbish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with that you also speak to a kind of, you mentioned it also in your book, a kind of cynicism that often comes then to that kind of possibility that, you know, people say, yeah, that's, yeah, come on, that's not possible. How do you, what in your sense is the way to move beyond that kind of cynicism that we maybe just not able to do it or not smart enough or wise enough?
Cynicism is quite a safe place to be. It's a lazy place to be. It doesn't take much effort to be cynical. You can just, and it just, you're just going around shutting down possibilities all around you. And maybe sometimes that's justified, but there'll be many other times when actually it's really, really deeply unhelpful. And I guess for me, I see that one of the best ways to challenge that is to create examples and gather examples that show that that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of the work in transition, I guess, has been of people who say, well, of course, you know, if we actually tackled climate change meaningfully, we would all be living in a cold cave eating green potatoes and feeling thoroughly miserable. Actually, the transition movement shows again and again and again and again and again that that's absolutely not the case. And that if we approach it right, addressing the climate emergency offers us the opportunity to address so many other things, so many other aspects of what's not working at the moment we can address by tackling the climate emergency. And actually, all most of the things we need to do to tackle the climate emergency are also much, much better for mental health, for physical health, for biodiversity. But we never really tell that story and celebrate what that could be. If we reframed addressing the climate emergency as a holistic society-wide mental health strategy, maybe we get more people on board and the benefits would be more apparent, but we would be doing most of the same things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting, because often that is also framed, this kind of change or transformation as kind of all the things we cannot do anymore or should not do anymore. And
yeah,
the kind of what we might, yeah, lose as, you know, ways to travel or whatever, but to tell the story in a different way, what we can actually get to say, or what we can actually, the richness in which we can move into as human beings. And also I think that's really true, that it's often also very compartmentalized, you know, the climate the climate issue, so to say, and then other environmental issue, and then mental health, and then economic inequality and racism, and but it's all
the same thing. It's all the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, when you go to, so I mentioned before about like Utrecht. So in the Netherlands, the Dutch government spend €500 million every year building the best cycling infrastructure in the world. And their logic is that they know through research they've done that that saves them 19 billion euros off the national health bill. Mm-hmm. People in the Netherlands live 6 months longer than the European average because of that. So we can look at that. Okay, so you're going to invest in cycling infrastructure. It's not an expense. It's an investment because you're saving like 30 times more over here off other things. Well, you could apply that. We know that it costs £1.2 million in the UK when a child goes into care over their time in care. I can't even remember how much it costs to put somebody in prison. I think it's like £50,000-£60,000 a year to have somebody in prison. But we know that if you invest in the first 5 years of a child's life with good nutritious food, with support for parenting, with all the support that is needed educationally, it makes the most enormous difference later in life. It hugely reduces their likelihood to be offending. We know that most people who end up in prison, something like 70% of people who are sent to prison, were homeless in the 6 months before they ended up being sent to prison. So it's not like you say, well, we are going to have housing strategy over here, mental health strategy over here, and food policy over here. They're all part of the same thing. We can't look at all of these things separately from each other. If we want to build a good, healthy, well-nourished society, we seem to be able to spend billions of pounds having wars with people, but not invest any money in doing anything that actually teaches people the skills to manage conflict and have that as part of our education system. And, you know, it's like we've got it all wrong. And it's not that difficult to figure out how we could do it much better, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting that is the power of imagination in a certain way to open the door wide, you know, like,
yeah,
imaginative is not like, oh, maybe let's do a little bit here. And it's like, wow, that's, that's why, yeah, it has this power. It's like, maybe let's rethink the whole thing reimagine the whole thing. And I think it's not a kind of mental only strategy, rational approach. It's more this kind of also artistic and somehow wholeness oriented approach of reimagining the whole way of how we are as human beings, and I think that's a real power to
yeah. It's one of the things that I learned when I was writing From What Is to What If was that the imagination loves limits. Mm-hmm. You know, that actually we look at limits as being a bad thing and somehow a constraint. But actually, if you look at things like there's a very famous English children's book called The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss, the man who wrote The Grinch and The Lorax and these stories. And he wrote a book called The Cat in the Hat, which just uses 50 words. And he said that actually when he put that limit on himself, it made him so much more imaginative. When you study improvisation, the teacher doesn't just say, make up a story. The teacher will say, Mike, you're getting on to, you're a bus driver. You've had a long day. You're really tired and grumpy. You just want to get home. And Rob, you're getting onto the bus with a very large musical instrument. Go. And you have to make up a story, but you have the limits there. And it helps you to do that, right? And it's why donut economics, I think, is such a brilliant, brilliant concept. And I've seen it again and again in workshops with donut economics. That it identifies the sweet spot. It identifies the limits. It says, we can't keep doing what we've done before because we are pushing it into all these planetary boundaries. We can't do that. And we have to protect the social foundation so people have well-paid jobs and people are able to live good lives. So in order to do that, we have to design and be brilliant within this sweet spot here, what Kate calls the donut. And I've seen it again and again. When you identify that space, people are so imaginative, and so they come up with so much better ideas than people like Donald Trump, who imagine there are no limits and are therefore among the most profoundly imagination bereft people in the universe. You know, the imagination loves limits, and we have to recognize that if we facilitate it properly, people are capable of brilliant leaps of imagination, even in times that are as challenging as what we're facing right now.
That's interesting. That also somehow that the imagination also needs the resistance of the concrete or of something that is actually where you see like, oh, wait a moment, this could be really different.
Yeah.
And then move into that.
My favorite definition of imagination is by John Dewey, who was a philosopher and an educationalist. He said, imagination is the ability to see things as if they could be otherwise. And if it feels like if there's a superpower that we need right now, it's the ability to see things as if they could be otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And coming back also to where we started with this questions, what can we trust? It feels to me also that there is a source of trust in a way in that imaginative capacity and this kind of longing, that also trust that there is something to reach for in each other and in other people. I mean, because you said also it's so polarized, often the discourse, and everyone is kind of different opinions, fighting each other and all of that, and it somehow feels hard to reach each other and things like that. And I feel what you were saying, or what I'm getting also from our conversation, is that it's also something really it's also a leap maybe of imagination to trust that this is there in us, in us human beings, the capacity to long for a better future in that way, and to participate in it, and to participate in imagining how that is, and build it together.
When I was doing the research for From What Is to What If, I interviewed a woman called Dr. Marjorie Taylor, who is a professor in the United States, who has spent the last 30 years doing research with children between the ages of 3 and 5, kind of assessing their imaginative capacity, how imaginative they are. And she said to me, I've been doing this work for 30 years, I haven't seen a change. So between 3 and 5, our children have these very, very active, very vigorous imaginations. We're born with them, right? It's like if you ran a kindergarten for 3-year-olds and none of them had any imagination, you give them a piece of paper and some crayons and they would just go, I don't know what to do. We would think, oh my God, this is terrible. What's going on here? What has happened to these children? Having a kind of active imagination where you give them a cardboard box and they can turn it into a spaceship or a house or a palace or a submarine or whatever. We see that as just natural. That's how kids are, right? Mm. But then something happens after the age of 5 where their imaginations just shrink very, very quickly to produce adults now where we think, oh, I don't have an imagination. I speak to adults who say, oh, I don't have an imagination, you know, but we see that as being normal and that as being natural. Actually, the natural state was those kids before they went to school. And actually that imagination, we should have an education system that fosters that and builds on that and loves that, and nourishes that, and honors that. And so kids come out of school with that same sense of this cardboard box could be a submarine or a palace or a house. This town could be this, it could be that, it could be the other. You know, when you're faced with a challenge, we have homelessness in our town. Well, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this, we could do this. The fact that we don't have that does not mean that that's natural. That means that we are living in a culture that doesn't respect the imagination, gives no priority to it, and people live lives of imaginative poverty, and that's not normal, which is why when people get the opportunity to do improvisation or to join a theatre group or to join an art class or to write something, and the imagination—it's why it feels so good. Like the imagination is our—it's like us. For me, A vigorous imagination is an indicator that everything else is in good balance. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of something that accompanies us being in good physical and mental health, is that we have an active imagination. And if we don't have an imagination, it doesn't mean that it's normal. It means that a certain set of conditions imposed around us have caused our imagination to contract and dwindle, and we need to fight really hard to claim it back. Because once a population loses its imagination, we are in a whole lot of trouble. And I think it's what we're seeing now happening in places like the US, where you've had since the 90s this kind of concerted kind of erosion of the imagination, the devaluing of the arts, the defunding of the arts, and all the other factors, the rise in stress, the rise in cortisol, more and more people feeling precarious. We live in a kind of cortisol economy, which is profoundly damaging to the human imagination at the very time when our survival depends on us being as imaginative as we could possibly be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very powerful, because it shows the kind of crisis and turning point we are in, and in a way it also shows the possibility. You know, I mean, I think it remembers me, there's this German artist, Joseph Beuys, who said every human being is an artist. And I think he meant it that way, that we all have that creative capacity. And that is actually the strongest capital, the strongest resource of a society to create, to invest in. And I think there is so much truth in that, in the way you are saying that to nurture that is not only, you know, a way to find new ways how to deal with all these challenges we are in, but to actually liberate who we are actually as human beings, and you know, the kind of happiness and joy that then comes from that, and also the ways of community, how community becomes possible when we do this together. You know, like you're saying, when we do this kind of creative things together, it's just so much fun and so much.
Yeah. And you can look back at certain kind of times in histories, often kind of around the times of revolutions, when there is that sense that anything is possible. You know, I love reading stuff because it's the year I was born, but looking back to the student revolution in Paris in May 1968, and how that was that whole revolution that came within a day of bringing the government down in France, that revolution was all framed around the imagination and this sort of the incredible like workshops of people printing these beautiful posters that were put up all around the city, and the role of music and poems, and people like the cup were just having debates and conversations in cafes and on street corners, and well, maybe we could redo that, and we could, and that sense of possibility that actually we can reshape and retake that. I want to experience that now. I want my kids to live in a world that feels like that. They tend historically to be quite brief periods of time, but quite extraordinary periods of time, and I think just the fact that, you know, we need one now, it's time for another one of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. I just remember I grew up in East Germany, and I also had that sense after the wall came down, there was this opening of possibility.
Of course, yeah.
How could it be now? How you know, this kind of imaginative space opened and it closed again, but there was this kind of excitement. Wow, maybe we could create a whole new society, and I think to draw on that is so important now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now's the time, Mike. Now's the time.
Yeah, thank you much. Thank you very much, Rob.
My
I really enjoyed
pleasure.
That conversation.
Me too.
Thank you.
Pleasure.